Today I am bringing a little bit of Mongolia into this discourse, and I will do it talking about some key concepts that can show how divination and, in general, the perception of the world changed from the period of the early Mongols, when the Mongols were not yet an empire, to the formation of a united empire, and then what was their legacy to different parts of Eurasia. And we will start from the chronological beginning. So, about divination, in Mongol culture has been written a lot. Divination was very important, and there are quite a few texts, mostly from a period later than the one I'm researching, a lot from the Qing period, from the 18th, 19th century. Quite a few in Europe, especially about 30, 40 texts related to astrology and divination are kept in the library in Copenhagen, and that has been studied in depth. One of the first scholars, and one of the most important to study them, was Charles Bodden, who is also the one who presented the first categorization, the first kind of formulation of categories for Mongolian divination. And he divides the types of divination among the Mongols in two types. That is, divination related to astrology, dependent from astrology and astrological notions, and divination independent from astrology. And this second type is again divided in two subcategories, that is divination, unintentional divination and intentional divination. The difference between two categories is in the intentionality or introducing the signs, of course. The unintentional divination is the understanding of omens, and the intentional divination, we will see there are different categories, but it's basically everything related to signs that are produced by the divination experts. I have been researching a little bit traces of these kinds of divination in documents related to the early Mongols, and of course, the most important text is The Secret History of the Mongols. Perhaps you have heard about it. It's a text probably from the half of the 13th century. The date is not sure. And it's about the origin of the Mongols and the origin of Genghis Khan. And there is a lot about this kind of unintentional divination. There are a lot of omens that are mostly related to animals. So, for example, the barking of dogs, or the movement, how the horses move, and so on. And they have quite a symbolic value. So here I have chosen one example that is a little bit that is interesting, because it's a little bit in between. Dream divination is considered the category of intentional divination. But in The Secret History of the Mongols, we find that these omens related to the behavior of animals very frequently as appearance in dreams. And they have very symbolic meanings, because these dreams are prophecy that come always when the charisma of Genghis Khan must be symbolized. Okay? So this, okay, a little bit of context, because this is a very interesting passage. It's the moment when Genghis Khan separates from his one friend Jamukha, and so basically he's creating a group, he's leaving the society, the social group he's in, and he's putting together a new group that will be the beginning then of his confederation. And we see that One important aspect of prophecies or omen in general is that they justify the change of established social structure. Because here we are speaking about a rebellion. So Corci is going against his family ties, against the clan, to unite to Genghis Khan. So there is this idea among the Mongols that was also used during the empire, that basically divination or prophecy or signs and the understanding of it, they delegate agency. So they basically put the responsibility of a social change upon heaven. There are two interesting things here if you want to read the whole text. Of course, the color of the animals, it's not casual. There is always a reference to the white or the yellow. It's a symbol of, it's a relation to light. So, and light is connected to divine charisma and to heaven. So that's why the animals have this color. And one important thing, if you see the last sentences, that these signs are revealed to Corci, who is the one having the dream. So basically, this dream doesn't need a mediator. There is no need for a divination expert to interpret this dream. And this is very characteristic of all the example we find in the secret history. So it's the fact that the omen is so clear that it doesn't need an expert to interpret it, it's probably related to the kind of source. Here we are speaking about the origin of Genghis Khan, so it must be clear to everybody that he's the leader and that he's the founder of an empire. That's why there is always this rhetoric of self-evidence, and that's and this stress on the heavenly signs. This about unintentional divination. So now let's go a little bit on the side of intentional divination. There are a lot of different kinds. Here I have put just a few so that you see the a little bit of Mongolian language on the screen. And the scapulimancy, of course, it's the most characteristic, and it will be used in the period of the United Empire and even later as a symbol of Mongolian identity. We will see later that the Mongol emperors are almost expected to practice scapulimancy. So it's a very Mongolian way of divination. And One interesting kind of divination is the one with coins, that you don't need to understand Mongolian, but of course you see that there is a reference to China. So we see that divination practices among the Mongols came from different parts. It was very syncretic. They took practices from wherever they could. And we see it also from the language. So they took coin divination as a tradition from China. We have, in the famous text I've talked about, there is a description of this kind of divination that Bodin has studied. And basically, this coin divination was done with 9 coins, and only one of which had marks on it. And basically, they were shaking the coins and looking at what session the coin with signs was coming out. And then they had the manual to read the meaning of it. 9 is, of course, a symbolic number for the Mongols. So there is this mixture of practice. And what I wanted to stress here is the fact that Mongolian divination practices among the Mongols is very syncretic from the beginning. About scapulimancy, there are two texts that have been analyzed, and also from a later period. I have put here an example because I thought perhaps it's nice to see. So this is a manual explaining how to read the cracks, and there are a couple of examples that have been translated by Boden. So and this manual was in use in Inner Mongolia still at the beginning of the 20th century. About this type of intentional divination. All this, one important thing is that all these different kinds, we have seen the specific terms because we know them from the manuals that refers to these specific terms. But in general, all these different kinds of intentional divination are, comes under the name of tolge. Tolge, means, it has been translated as Mongolian, and it's been translated exactly as divination in general, or interpreting the science, or the divination expert is called Tolge Chin, and this Chi is the one who makes the action. So it's the one who interprets the science, but also the one who makes the sign. So there is a double meaning, the one who can read them, but also the one who can make them. And Tolge has been studied as a word in many studies. So basically, the main thesis by Ronatash is that it comes from the Turkic word tuluk, that means the spiritual force. So we see that the idea behind these signs, that they are a manifestation of a spiritual force. Okay? And here is another passage from the Secret History. That is the most important for to understand divination about the in the period of the early Mongols is the one that everybody quotes. So we are looking at it a little bit in detail because there are different layers in it. The context is this: we are already in the period of Ogodei, so the empire is founded, and there is the year 1231. There has been the campaign against the Khitan, and Ogodei fell sick, and they interrogate the shamans and diviners. So here we see there are some important things to notice, also to understand the parts afterwards. First thing is the second meaning of divination related to sickness, so related to medicine. Okay, there is this idea of course, it's not peculiar of the Mongols; it's common in many areas of Eurasia. This idea of the illness being caused by demons or spirits, and divination as a counterpart to medicine. It's not a substitute in this case, it's a counterpart. And this we find in other texts from Inner Asia. It's a context that is going on in Inner Asia. For one example I wanted to bring to you is the Kutaktu Bilik, that is a manual of the 11th century called The Wisdom of Royal Glory. And it's basically a collection of advices for the ruler, how to be a good ruler. And one of the advice is to treat with the same respect doctors and divination experts, because they treat those ills, and I quote, "They treat those ills which are caused by devil or a demon. You ought to be in good terms with them as well, in case you need them to utter a spell against the illness of that sort. So treat them kindly if you wish to profit from them. The physician does not like the diviner's spell. So as the diviner turns his back on the physician, so take the medicine the one prescribes to cure your sickness, and grasp the amulet the other incants to drive away the devils." So we see that that's a very typical way of doing also among the Mongols. They are interested in what works, not in the nobility of the practice or of the institution. So one other important element is the distinction between Boge and Tolge Chin. What does it mean? Again, this is a very important distinction in matters of identity. Okay? So the Mongols, they are in a context. There are all these influence going on, but they maintain always a very clear markers of their own identity. And this is the Böge. Böge is the word for shaman, and it indicates the Mongolian shaman. And Telgechin are basically all the others who interpret the sign with practices that comes from abroad or not. The distinction is that the Böge, the shaman, he can also be a Telgechin, but not the contrary. The relation is very simple, and it has been explained also in political terms. So basically, the shaman, contrary to the divination practitioners of intentional divination, the shaman is the one who can speak to the spirits. So he has a connection to the spirits of the dead, to the spirits of the past, and this is something that he only can do. And this has been related, for example, by Herbert Franke, to the fact that at the very beginning, the figure of the shaman was mixed up with the chief of a clan. So it was also a political figure. And in fact, also in the secret history, there is a political value in it. This distinction that is a very clear political context in the period of the early Mongols is preserved also in the period of the empire and the Khanates. So when we see a description of divination, for example, in the Chinese sources or in the Persian sources, there is always the duality of shamans, who are the ones who are the Mongolian ones who speak Mongolian, and they have a very high position, a higher position than the other ones. And then, for example, in the West can be Sufis. In the East, we will see it's other the divination experts, it's experts of the yin yang divination. But this distinction between the two is always preserved. And another important element here is the reference here to the spirits of the lands and waters. That is, the Rakhmetz has translated this expression in periods after the secret history of the Mongols. This is the expression that will signify geomancy. So there is an idea still there, although the Mongols were not expert of geomancy. They took it from the Chinese, from the Persian. They took many notions. But there is an idea here that will be expanded afterwards with the influence of other culture of the influence of the earth, not only of the sky, okay? And then we have here another dimension, as we have seen before, of another kind of divination, that the one looking at the entrails of animals. Why this element is important? To show you how was practiced divination among the Mongols. There was a redundance, because we see there are the shamans, there are the divination experts, and then there is a third form of divination. So this element of many forms of divination at the same time, it's very typical. And it's basically always the case at the court of the Mongols, and it shows also the fact that the Mongols were open to everybody who could who could confirm a result. Okay, and we will see that this result is there is a particular idea behind that. So we have seen this idea of syncretism and this idea of everything that works, and these are the two principles with which the Mongols went into the construction of an empire, and they used divination for their own to form their own political identity, and also to to foster the universality of the empire. Okay? So what I have been looking at is how was the nation described in relation to the ruler first, and how was it used to express concepts like the perception of time or like the perception of charismatic authority. And one very important question is, who was practicing divination in the Mongol Empire? And we find a very interesting fact that the emperors were practicing divination. This was a very specific characteristic that we find in many sources. For example, we have the account of William of Rubruck about monk requesting a practice in divination. We have a biography of Yeluchu Tsai in the history of the Yuan dynasty about Genghis Khan practicing divination. So the emperors, they have to know how to practice divination. That is, as I told before, scapulimancy, most of all. And here I have put an example from the Persian source, the Jamil al-Tawarikh, about Hulegu, and we see that here divination it's very positively described. So it's an important thing to know divination, and it's a branch of knowledge which is important for the ruler, and. And the question is why? How does divination construct the idea of an emperor first, and then of a universal ruler second? You know, and my idea, okay, I think that this connection of divination and imperial authority based on two elements. That is the perception of time and the perception of and the representation of royal charisma. About the perception of time, I have to mention another work. Again, everything we know about this period, about the period of the Mongol Empire and the Khanates come from afterwards. So Bauman translated the manual of mathematics and divination, again from a later period. And it's a very recent work. It's very rich, and there is a lot about Buddhist sciences, mathematics, and divination as well. The point that is interesting here is about the perception of time. So how did the Mongol perceive time? Although they had, of course, many Buddhist influences, okay, the way the Mongols adapted to the and took input from the world outside, it's basically through goes a lot through Buddhism that arrived to them through the Uyghurs or through the Tibetans, okay. But nevertheless, they have a very specific idea of time that is divided into occasions. And this idea of occasion is very important because it reflects the concept of kinship. So we see that the Mongols built a rhetoric of kinship all based on timeliness. So how does the authority of the ruler express itself? Because the ruler knows the exact time. He arrives at the exact time. He takes the power at the right time. And this was used, this idea of time was used as the ground for a syncretic representation of kingship. And here I have put two examples. From the period of the Mongol Empire, the Mongol Khanates onwards, we start to see some titles that are new or that read anew some old concept. In the West, for example, for the Timurid, Asfar Moin has studied this title of Sahib Kiran, that is the Lord of Auspicious Conjunction, and here it's very clear the connection to astrological theories, because it's really a cosmological conjunction. Okay, for the Chinese sources, what I have found is this new meaning of timeliness. So there is this idea of yun that has been studied. The title from the Mongol Empire, the Yuan dynasty, they use this yun as an attribute of the ruler. And this has been studied by Olsen and other. But there is a new meaning into that. Yun, it's a very old Confucian concept, and it's related to, of course, to a cyclical renewal. And what they do here is to express it in a different way, as again, similarly to Saheb Kiran, as a conjunction. It's, of course, there is the idea of the cycle, but it's a moment. It's the right moment to grasp the time. And this, it's very typical from the Yuan dynasty, and then it will be taken on during the Qing dynasty. But it's an innovation that I think is connected exactly to this perception of time as expressed in terms of occasion. Okay, so if we see these references to time in the imperial titles, we understand that it's important for the emperors to have an understanding of time, to have a notion, and to know what is the right time to do war, to do everything. And so this is the first connection to the sciences related to divination and to astrology. Another aspect that I think it's connected to this embodiment of time from the side of the emperor is, again, in the history of the Yuan dynasty, there is a part on state ritual. And it's a very interesting section of the Yuanshi, because here we see exactly the mixture of Mongolian tradition and Chinese ritual. Okay, so the Kublai and the Yuan emperors, they kept their tradition of and their Mongolian rites, and they mixed it up with other rites, and the ceremonies they kept are connected to an idea of time that is, of course, related to seasonality and to the lifestyle of the pastoral nomads. They had special rites for when Kublai was transhuming in the summer and so on. But this is a particular rite that happens before the new year. It has been translated in German by Rachnevsky, and it has been treated in Chinese by a Chinese scholar, Ma Xiaolin. And here I have summarized it. So basically, we see a different relation. So we have seen in the titles the whole idea of the emperor as the one who grasps the time, who knows the time, and so on. And here, and the one who does scapolimancy together with the divination expert. Okay, so there is a equality, or the emperor was in a higher position. Here is exactly the contrary. The emperor is the object of the ritual, but the one who performs the ritual is the shaman. Again, this importance given to the Mongolian shaman, and there are, of course, some symbolic elements. So basically, the emperor and the family members are tied up with the hair from black and white sheep. So we have the black and white, the two opposite to signify the whole, okay? And there are some ceremonies with the smoke and so on, but it's the shaman, the one who cuts the rope. So basically, okay, this rite is understood as to signify that the renovation of time in terms of the helplessness of the newborn. So it's like the emperor is reborn. Okay, and so the body of the emperor represents the renovation of time. There is a very strong connection between this idea of time and of imperial identity. And Now we give authority to the emperor again, and we go back to the idea of imperial charisma. So it has been showed that divination is one of the ways the emperor shows imperial charisma. Why? There is, again, a concept that is not peculiar to the Mongols. It's a concept that the Mongols have in common, at least with the Chinese. There is this idea of, in this case, medicine and government as being on the same level in terms of making order into the disorder. And they are expressed by the same word. So if we understand all sciences or all technical skills as being on the same level, every scholar that was at the Mongol court or every divination expert, it was a resonance of the imperial charisma of the emperor. And in fact, we find exactly the same expression, exactly the same context of governing in the biography of Yulu Chuzai, a very important advisor of the Mongol emperors and an expert of divination himself. And we have this whole idea of governing that is compared to technical skills and to scientific knowledge and so on and so forth. And this, for the one who of you who studied the European Middle Ages, has been expressed in the thesis of Marie Helms, who speaks exactly of this kind of charisma in the work of artisans or skilled personnel. And one important thing here is we have seen the different stages of the relationship between divination and the expert and who practice this divination. So the emperor and the divination experts. And here we have a complete separation. So the divination experts are a specialized category of people, and that's their job. Their job is based on the fact that it has a resonance to the job of the ruler. So this resonance is expressed in very romantic terms in the biography of one of the divination experts I have been studying. This answers a little bit the question of what was the role of divination for the emperors, okay? If we see the Persian sources, Rowena Amitai has shown that the Mongols emperor, they didn't really have an interest in the result of divination. They were just interested in the fact that divination was confirming their choices. And also, that's also why they were doing divination by themselves. And that's true, especially in matters of deciding if to go to war or not, and so on. The Chinese sources present us a little bit different idea that is based on this idea of resonance of the soul, of the spirit of the emperor as an emperor, as a charismatic authority, and divination per se. So we have two examples. One word about this divination expert is he has a very interesting biography that expresses very well how the Mongols approached divination. So defined as a yin yang expert, but he's basically asked to do everything. He has to do physiognomy, weather magic, he has to calculate the dates, he has to read omens, and so on and so forth. And the second, The second quote it's exactly it refers exactly to an episode where he has to perform physiognomy. So basically, Kubilai puts him in a room with different people, and he has to decide which person has to be the general of an expedition to the south. And he looks at the face of Bayan, and he recognizes him as a warrior, and chooses him. And here we see that, in fact, Kubilai, he's happy because it was exactly his choice. So we have this idea of the work of the divination expert confirming and being in harmony with the way of governing of the emperor, but also with his soul. And this brings up to a further stage. Now we leave a little bit the realm of ideology, and we become a little bit more practical. What I wanted to talk about is agency and the agents, because since divination was so important for the construction of imperial identity, the people who practiced this divination had a lot of power, and this has been expressed not only in the realm of divination with the concept of agency. So agency goes in two directions. So basically, the Mongols have this empire where there is a lot going on in terms of sciences and technologies and skills. What they foster is what can be useful for them. So divination is one of these things because it's important for an emperor. So the idea of the emperor is that of the universal emperor is of course that he has this control, that he governs heaven and earth. So for them it was very, very important to foster all kind of sciences which allowed a better understanding of earth, so geomancy, and of heaven, so astrology, astronomy, and so on and so forth, and also geography, for example. The other aspect of agency is the one on the other side, from the side of the mediator, who of course used the situation for their advantage, so to promote a school of thought instead of the others. And then also you see there was the increasing of divination experts. Everybody was able to do divination under the Mongols because it was a very, very lucrative business. They paid a lot, these divination experts. And so how did this agency concretize itself? We see two examples. They built center of learning. In this case, it's astronomical observatories. The Malaga one was also a center of learning. So they were interested in gathering these scholars, these experts. And there was, of course, the increasing of course and culture. They had to put them all together because they had to show all their charisma, basically. And this quotes that comes almost at the end is actually the beginning of my interest in divination. And it's an edict that Kubilai sends to the king of Dyvet. And we see the main idea beyond that is there is this practice of diplomacy of the Mongols that they request not only goods but also people. The interesting thing here is there is the division between physicians, doctors, and experts of divination, as we have seen in the other texts from the 11th century. But the expert of divination are at the same level as scholars. So, although all these diviners are still referred to as fangji, that is a little bit it's not a positive connotation. In the Mongol Empire, they are treated as scholars. at the same level as scholars. So they are given a lot of importance. And the interesting fact here is why they are asking Yin Yang, expert of Yin Yang divination to the ruler of Vietnam. And this, again, refers to the very, very general way of the Mongols of describing divination. So basically, Yin Yang divination is the Chinese counterpart, or the counterpart in the Chinese sources of the Tolge Chin that we have found before. So it's a general way of they didn't mean anything really connected to Yin Yang. They mostly meant geomancy with this, but the term Yin Yang divination is used also to refer to Persian divination experts, and that are called Huihui, because that was the denomination of people coming from the West in that period. So we see that there is a very, very uncertainty in the translation of the terms, or in the representation of divination per se. And this makes the things a little bit difficult, because we never know when we find a Yin Yang expert if he's coming from the West, from the South, from the East. We never know. One last important idea that has been considered the peculiar aspect of that China put in the application of Mongol rule. So not the influence of the Mongols, but it's the way that the Chinese found to make use of this period of Mongol rule is bureaucratization. That is basically the construction of offices and the application of administrative kind of mentality to this interest of the Mongol emperors of gathering experts. And this comes from a biography that we will see tomorrow in the reading group. It's a very famous passage. This Jin De Jin is another one of this Yin Yang expert, whose biography is contained in the Yuanxi. There are only three of them, so this is the second one. And he has a mixed formation, let's say. He counts as a Confucian. He is employed as an expert of Yin Yang. He is asked to do any kind of divination. The important aspect here, there are three elements here that are important. First, we see another and perhaps the most important use of divination that is applied to war. So the context here is, for the one who don't know the specific of UN history, is the civil war between Kublai and Erik Bouquet. So Kublai, So basically elected himself emperor of the Mongols, and not all members of the imperial family agreed. So there was a civil war. Okay? And during the civil war, as during all of the wars, the divination experts were going together with the military and practicing divination on the field. And history says that Kublai won, and this was used to define what is actually science and what is not. And we see again this idea that what works, because Erik Bouquet has his divination expert, and Kublai had his divination expert, but Erik Bouquet lost. So basically, what they are saying here is their divination expert and the practices that they are using are simply sorcery. But our divination practices, since we won, are the real science. And in fact, we see that there is this idea of savants, of scholarly. It's putting up it's really elevating the idea of divination at the level of a science. And there is the and then Jindijin grasped this occasion because Kublai had just won, and he asks for to establish a school, to establish a structure for the gathering of young experts. So there is a whole process going on. The school will be funded. It will be, of course, at the regional level. Then there will be a central school. It will be connected to the Bureau of Astronomical Observation, and under the coordination of the Imperial Library. So we see that again, even in this process of bureaucratization, there is always this idea of connecting all the sciences related to heaven and earth, because the same office was responsible for divination, astronomy, and geography. So there is this general idea of the sciences of heaven and earth. And we see this process of centralization. So basically there are schools, there are exams, and only the best ones are then sent to the court to form this gathering of scholars that we have seen before. And now, as a conclusion, a thought that I open to you as well, because your cluster is about talks about the future and coping with the future. But it's my impression that divination among the Mongols, it was very less about the future, but about this idea of occasions. No, so there is this idea of time as being connected to the past, of time being present. So basically, the future is simply it's very close to a present that has to be understood and managed in the right way. So with this, I think. Thank you.